Good afternoon, you're listening to a B Radio News broadcast with me, Luke Austin.
Me, Harry Price.
And me, Captain Mingongo.
We're going to give you a quick update on today's national and local news stories, followed by local news and an in-depth look at some of the news stories affecting all of us.
And finally, we'll finish with an exclusive interview with Nigel Shipley from Extinction Rebellion, followed by a discussion about what he has to say about the group and its climate goals.
Let's get into this afternoon's top stories. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced new legislation that could mean any small migrant boats crossing the channel would be detained and deported from the UK. A source from Whitehall that spoke to the Guardian newspaper suggested that children and families are likely to be included in the legislation, as the government aims to stop an estimated 60,000 a year from crossing the channel. It comes under increasing pressure from the public and the PM's own party to clamp down on so-called illegal crossings. The Prime Minister told the Mail on Sunday that stopping the boats is his top priority, and went on to say that, make no mistake, if you come here illegally, you will not be able to stay. The Labour Shadow Health Secretary has responded to the new legislation, suggesting that it is just the latest in a long line of unworkable gimmicks. The PM has also facing criticism from migrant charities, including Freedom From Torture, who call the plans vindictive and dysfunctional. The latest figures from the Home Office say that more than 45,000 migrants crossing the channel last year in small boats.
Police in Cardiff searching for two men and three women who had gone missing after a night out on Saturday have found the group in a wreckage of a car crash in St Mellons, a suburb just outside the city. Three of the group were found dead at the scene of the crash, whilst the other two, one of whom is 20, Sophie Rurison, has been taken to hospital in critical condition. Understood that the three young women who had travelled from Porth Crawl in Brigden County, whilst the two slightly older men were from Cardiff. Although it's not clear at this stage what the intentions of the group were, nor what caused the crash, a tweet from South Wales Police says that the A48 in Cardiff is currently closed in all directions and is expected to remain closed for some time. They also added the specialist officers are supporting the families and ask anyone with information to call the police directly on 101.
The ex-Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who left office in 2022 after a series of scandals, may be putting his own father, Stanley Johnson, forward for a knighthood on his honours list. A member of Boris Johnson's staff has said in a statement that we do not comment on honours. The suggestion of a knighthood for the 82-year-old Stanley Johnson, who's a former Conservative member of the European Parliament, has resurfaced allegations of cronyism and corruption against the former PM. Johnson's father has faced allegations of sexual harassment and vulgar comments made against women in the 2003 party conference, which, although he has denied, calls into question the necessity of his appointment from his own son. Boris Johnson's honours list includes as many as 100 names which are due to be vetted in by the Cabinet Office.
The attendance of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, to the King's coronation is not yet clear, as although the couple have been invited via email to the event, they are yet to decide on whether or not they will be attending. According to the BBC, in a previous interview about his book known as Spare, Prince Harry declined to comment on whether or not he would be at his father's coronation. It's also not clear what role, if any, he would be given as part of the event if he were to attend, given the difficult relationship the couple have with the working royal family. During the Queen's Platinum Jubilee celebrations last year, the couple were not included in the event, suggesting that although they were in attendance at the Queen's funeral in September, they are unlikely to attend official royal events in future.
And lastly, looking in the world of sport, Liverpool have thrashed Manchester United in the so-called record-breaking match for the team, which ended in a 7-0 win in the Premier League game yesterday afternoon. The first half was seen to be a tight match between the two teams, with lots of near misses for both sides, ending in two goals for Liverpool. The second half was a different story, however, with Liverpool dominating Man United with a further five goals, two of which came from the team's top player, Mo Salah. This moves Liverpool into the fifth place in the Premier League, with Man United holding on to third position for now.
And now we'll pan back over to Harry in a second for the local news update.
Here in local news, wishing for a white Christmas? Well, maybe that wish has come early or late, as BBC Weather predicts snowfall in Berkshire. Areas said to be affected are Reading, Slough, Bracknell, Maidenhead, Woking and Newbury, as the snowfall is predicted to come tomorrow, Tuesday the 7th of March. Unfortunately, this may see delays to rail and road networks, so make sure to check before you travel. In other news, pensioner pulled to the floor as two suspects steal her bad bag. The incident took place in Reading at 9:30 along Silver Street. Although the woman was not injured, her bag was successfully stolen by the two suspects. One of these offenders has been described as a man wearing a zipped hooded top, blue jeans, black Nike trainers with a white tick on the side, a blue face and a blue face covering, and a grey cap. Thames Valley Police are now appealing for witnesses of the robbery, as well as they encourage those who parked cars along Silver Street to check their dash cam footage. Anyone with information can call 101, quoting reference 43230098991. Again, Berkshire family terrified after the release of a BA pilot who murdered his wife. Robert Brown brutally bludgeoned to death his 46-year-old wife, Jonah, with a claw hammer in their family home as their two young children cowered in the playroom. The mother of the woman killed by her husband said the family is fearful about his release. She is calling on the Justice Secretary to look into the case. The motive behind the brutal killing was Robert's belief that he'd been stitched up by the prenuptial agreement, then dumped the body in a makeshift coffin in Windsor Great Park. Brown was sentenced to 24 years for manslaughter and a further 2 years for offence of obstruction of justice. Brown is expected to be released from prison in November this year.
Following last week's announcement of Glastonbury's headlines, the Arctic Monkeys and Guns N' Roses will join Sir Elton John on the headliners on the Pyramid stage. This has caused controversy among festival goers and music lovers, as there's an absence of female headliners. 53% of the 55 acts announced so far are men. The lack of diversity is despite the festival's previous aspirations to move towards a 50-50 lineup split of male and female artists. Emily Evis, co-organiser of the festival, explained that it was a problem in the industry pipeline and that record companies and radios need to get on board with its development in order for the bill to be balanced in all festivals. This debacle has opened the conversation on the crisis that is the UK music industry, where a YouGov survey found that only 1 in 10 headliners at the UK's top festivals are women. When she spoke to The Guardian, she mentioned that diversity of all identities, mentioning that 46% of the lineup's features include people of colour. This news has ruffled feathers among musicians themselves, as singer-songwriter Lana Del Rey has even suggested she might pull out of the festival as she displayed her discontent about the lineup order on her Instagram. However, despite this inequality, Evis told The Guardian that there will be hopefully 2 female headliners in next year's festival who have never performed at Glastonbury before, and fans are speculating that this is Rihanna and Madonna, but we shall stay tuned on this. And my question to you guys is, if you could have a female headliner, who would it be?
Oh, that is a good question, to be fair. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think I'd have to go for Little Sims. I think that would be a good shout.
That is a good shout. For me, I think Florence and the Machine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's quite a classic Glastonbury headliner, to be fair. Okay, well, thanks for that, Katia. I've been looking into something which I'm sure you both will have noticed, is the shortage of tomatoes and salads and peppers and things like that kind of produce.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, I haven't had tomatoes in my sandwich for a while now. It's not the biggest, most pressing issue in the world, but it's a little bit annoying for me at least. But it seems like the UK is in the grip of yet another shortage of a particular food product that we've had. You know, we had eggs before and there were a few others as well. So I've been trying to get to the bottom of this, as there's kind of speculation in the media about what is actually causing it. So first we heard from the major supermarket saying that it was caused by poor weather conditions in North Africa and southern Spain, and where much of the UK supply comes from, which obviously that's going to result in a poor harvest. And the Spanish government released a statement saying that the supplies are lower and have been affected by flooding and unexpected frosts in the region because of this, which does go to suggest that could be a potential reason. I'm guessing that's something you've both heard in the media the past few weeks, explaining it a little bit. So I think there's a little bit more to this than meets the eye, though, because it's, let's say, for example, the past couple of weeks, we've seen some pretty awkward tweets for the UK, from some politicians across Europe, showing a pretty full supply of tomatoes and salads on the shelves in supermarkets in France, Germany, and the Netherlands. And the EU Commission even issued a statement saying there is no particular situation of food shortage in the EU agricultural markets, which suggests that it's actually very much a UK-specific issue, really. I think.
Well, it's got to be Brexit then, hasn't it?
Yeah, you've hit the nail right on the head there. So it's exactly, you know, the obvious question is whether it's being caused by Brexit. And well, if we look at the trade rules with produce, such as tomatoes, they do require customs declarations and pre-notification for the UK government when entering the UK, which is all pretty boring, to be fair. But we spoke to a firm that processes these documents for, specifically for Spanish tomato producing firms, and they said it takes around 10 to 20 minutes to do so for each lorry.
Doesn't sound too bad.
It doesn't sound too bad, but you've got to remember the amount of lorries that are coming into the UK every day. That adds up to a pretty big cost, and it kind of makes the UK a little bit less competitive from that perspective. And so, although the Spanish government did issue a statement about the bad weather, they also said that that Brexit represents or presents a challenge for the entire Spanish fruit and vegetable sector, which is kind of indirectly suggesting that Brexit is to blame for the shortages of tomatoes specifically. And on top of that, we've had reports of an oversupply of tomatoes in the Netherlands, which is due to a large number of greenhouses, they produce a lot of tomatoes because of, they have a large number of greenhouses in southern Holland, which means we are one of their biggest importers. A Dutch tomato producer said that they used to export to the UK, but it now takes up to 77 hours of queuing for truck drivers to enter the UK, which means a lot of them just outright refuse. So, you know, it's really...
77 hours is a lot.
Yeah, you can see you can see why people are kind of going against that. And again, that's a potential byproduct of Brexit, meaning we're not getting that supply in from Europe. The other supply is about a fifth of our tomatoes come from the UK itself, and so you'd ask, you know, where are the UK tomatoes, I guess. And again, this brings us back to the B word on B Radio, which is Brexit, and the shortage of workers that the UK producers are struggling to find to pick the tomatoes. And on top of that, it's a unique way that supermarkets agree with UK growers, which means there's less price flexibility when the cost of producing goes up. So I think it's safe to say that the supermarkets definitely have a role to play in this.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So the supermarkets are essentially not paying the sort of a fair price for that. So we tried to reach out to one of the tomato producers in the UK, and we got a pretty disappointing response from the Greenhouse Sussex Limited, who said they won't discuss purchasing contracts, but they have, like everyone, been affected by rising costs. So all in all, I think it's safe to say that the shortages we're seeing have been caused by a perfect storm of issues, but definitely exacerbated by Brexit, a potential consequence that none of us really expected when we were voting for Brexit in May 2016 or whenever it was.
At all.
I don't think any of us foresaw the shortage of tomatoes becoming an issue, but there we go.
Sort of elaborating on what you were saying earlier in the headlines, I just want to talk a bit more about Rishi Sunak and the migrants crossing the channel and asylum seekers as well.
Okay.
So, as you were saying, Rishi Sunak vows to end asylum claims from small boats arriving and has made it a priority to reduce the immigration from that way. Speaking to the Mail on Sunday, he said, "Make no mistake, if you come here illegally, you will not be able to stay." Mm-hmm. So these are obviously quite harsh words.
Bold statement to make, yes.
Currently, asylum seekers coming to the UK have the right to seek protection under the UN's Refugee Convention and the European Convention on Human Rights. However, a clause in the Illegal Migration Bill is expected to allow these conventions to be circumvented.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so definitely there is, you know, a sign of a significant crackdown on immigration.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
The Refugee Council has attacked the government for shattering the UK's long-standing commitment under the UN Convention to give people a fair hearing, regardless of how they got to the UK.
Wow.
This clearly shows the Conservative government is continuing to proceed with not only an anti-immigration sentiment, but policy to match. It is most likely a ploy by the Prime Minister to move attention away from the cost of living crisis and instead draw people's attention to immigration.
Mm-hmm. They're definitely taking quite a strong stance on it, I think it's safe to say.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's quite a bold move from Rishi Sunak.
His justification, essentially, for all of this
is
that this harsh crackdown is due to the fact that they want to limit the human trafficking gangs who are responsible for the trafficking across the channel. However, I believe this is just yet another distraction. If the UK would simply grant more asylum to those seeking it, it would reduce the dependency on migrants to use human trafficking gangs as a way to actually cross the channel.
Definitely, that's a really good point.
Yeah. And exactly, in the fourth quarter of 2021, there were 21,961 asylum applications made to the Home Office. But if you look, only 3,379 of those were actually granted. Wow. So with such a with such a small number of those being granted, you know, you can understand why these why they're forced to take illegal channels into the UK.
Yeah, definitely, you can really see it. Yeah.
In sporting news, the GB's Keely Hodgkinson and Jasmine Sawyers have won gold in the European Indoor Championship. Hodgkinson has defended her 800 meter title as she finished well clear in 1:58.66, and Sawyer had won her first major title with a world-leading jump of 7 metres, where she told BBC, "I've never won anything, I'm still in shock, and I feel like 7-metre jump has been in me for so long." Hodgkinson and Sawyer's success on the final day of the competition took Britain's medal tally to 6, applauded by the nation as well as sporting legends such as Denise Lewis, a former heptathlete, who said, "To achieve 7 metres is just outstanding. I can't believe how well she puts it together." So well done to Keely and Jasmine for those amazing achievements.
Yeah, that's a really amazing achievement. Well done. Go Team GB, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. You wouldn't catch me doing 7 metres.
No, definitely not. No.
So I'd like to bring a story to attention that's affecting quite a lot of us, especially us younger people, but to be honest, people of all ages. And that is the renting crisis at the minute.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Something we can all talk about.
Yeah, definitely. With some areas seeing rent increases by 20%, according to Rightmove, these costs are seeing many priced out of the area, which means that the area that they've lived in maybe most of their life or the majority of their life, they're either forced to move out or downsize to one bed or studio apartments.
I mean, 20% is huge.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's almost double the rate of inflation. So it's just crazy.
Yeah, it certainly shows an element of... greed, I'd almost say.
Exploitation, definitely.
Rents aren't just rising in large cities such as London, but small towns are being affected. The local town of Newbury has seen rents rises as high as 22.2%.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so I'd imagine if you were living there right now, you'd be in quite a predicament, you know, trying to find somewhere to live next year. Although the national average of rental increase is only at 3.8%, according to the Office of National Statistics, this comes as, at the same time as the cost of living crisis, which continues to put pressure on people's wallets, especially those who are, you know, are low-income families who are stuck in the renting limbo. You know, these are people who probably won't have the opportunity, unfortunately, to own their own home, and they're, you know, increasingly being pressured by these rising renting costs.
And there's really little support as well from government.
Exactly. Like, from my own experience and the experience of students, many of them have had negative relations with their landlords. The most common complaints I've heard from are from mouldy walls, broken heating, to no hot water. Many of these issues simply being ignored or taking months to fix. This definitely calls on the question for more legal protection for tenants, including more stringent rent caps and rent freezes, as well as more tools to hold landlords accountable.
Well, let's hope some of our landlords are listening in. And
hopefully not.
Maybe they'll take note and up their game with looking after our houses.
Even in my house, we've struggled with mould on the walls and hot water issues. It's definitely an issue.
Just have to see how much of your deposit that you get back.
I think if we touch a little bit on the weather today. Waking up this morning, I've definitely got to say it was a grey and cloudy day today.
A bit of a cold one this morning.
Definitely seeing rain coming in the morning. And like I was saying earlier, with snow on the way,
snow on the way as well.
It's definitely, I don't know if you guys would class it as typical March weather.
No, I don't know. I was hoping for a bit more sun, to be honest.
Yeah, I know.
We're entering spring, so I thought that would be more sun than snow.
Yeah. So when's the snow due for then?
Literally coming tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday.
Okay. What parts, do we know what parts of Berkshire that's in? Is it Reading included as well?
Reading is included.
Okay, wow. Well, I'm not looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was looking forward to, the bit of a warm weather coming.
Warmer weather. Okay, well, we'll have to wait and see what happens there then.
Yeah, no, especially with, I don't know about you guys, but with my energy bill coming in.
That's a good point. Didn't even think about that.
Yeah, no, trying to, cut down on the heating the best I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's definitely going to be another, time to put the boiler on and, another...
Well, maybe climate change is to blame.
Yeah.
And I guess sort of our kind of weather fluctuations that we're seeing could be linked to climate change, which actually we have a little documentary to play in a bit, I think.
We're definitely going to be diving into climate change, and we're going to be discussing sort of the ways we as a consumer might be able to help climate change, or if in fact that the power is going to be out of our hands.
And we've got a an interview from Nigel Shipley, as we mentioned earlier, exclusive interview for B Radio from Extinction Rebellion, so hopefully you'll be able to hear a little bit about what he's got to say about the group and climate change in general. It's really interesting stuff, I think.
Then we've got a bit of a discussion about climate change and whether we as individuals have the responsibility or it's up to the government. So that's what we're touching on after this.
I think we could probably play that now.
We can definitely dive into that.
Great.
What can we do to combat climate change? Is it our responsibility, the consumer, or does it lay outside of our reach with governments and multinational corporations? Here to discuss this is me, Harry.
Kezia.
And Luke. And, well, I think actually we can do a lot as individuals to combat climate change. I mean, you've got the kind of usual things that you hear about talking about. So you've got like the normal things like saving energy and turning off light bulbs and things like that. But I think also you could look into your consumption and what you buy and where you buy it from, and trying to sort of work out whether what you're buying, whether it's clothes or whether it's buying less meat, to sort of determine how much of a impact what you're buying is having on the environment, I guess. What do you guys think?
I'm going to have to disagree with that, because I don't think the responsibility should be on the individuals. China, USA and India are the biggest greenhouse gas emitters, and combined they have almost 50% of the world's total emissions, and in comparison to the bottom 100, they only have 2.9, which is honestly insane. And I think it could be because of the amount of factories that are in these countries, but it's the responsibility of the state to make implications to control these high numbers.
I mean, I think that's right. Like, you're right that those countries are the biggest emitters of CO2. But at the end of the day, like, they are made up of consumers, and if the consumers in those countries, like us, were to change their habits as well, then that would kind of shift the way the economy runs there, and hopefully reduce the CO2 output there, for example.
Exactly. If you think about flying, for example, as a consumer choice, a simple trip between London, Gatwick and Malaga will produce half a ton of CO2, which is the equivalent of driving your car for like 2,500 miles.
Wow, that's crazy.
So if you're thinking of going on holiday, perhaps it's in your better interest as in your consumer choice to pick a location that is more local to you, perhaps somewhere inside of the UK, and taking public transport or driving to cut down your emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Not using cars and planes is a slightly far-reaching and unrealistic demand, because take the USA, for example. It has an infrastructure that perpetuates car dependence in the sense that pavements aren't common, and if you want to get from point A to point B, you have to use a private vehicle. So I wouldn't say it was the fault of the individuals, that there's nothing you really can do. It's more the fault of the government, who allow inconvenient, environmentally damaging architecture. Therefore, states should have the responsibility. And with that being said, it's unfair to demand people to give up their cars and switch to electric because not everyone can afford that and it will cause more damage in the long run.
I mean, I think that's all true, but and I think the US is a really good example of that. But also, whilst there are many consumers that can't switch their, how they get around, for example, there are also plenty of consumers that can. And I think that as individuals, you know, we've got to work out what we can afford to do and what we can do, and change that sort of thing. But
there are even super simple ways that you can reduce your own carbon footprint by without like any say intervention at all. For example, simply planting a tree in your back garden can absorb 25 kilograms of CO2 per year. And as well as if you plant wildflowers and grassland instead of having perfectly manicured lawns or paving stones, you can also create healthy habitats for wildlife, which help to have a positive effect on your local environment, which is always a good start.
Yeah,
that's a really good idea, but I feel like the government should be providing this to the individuals, because realistically not everyone can afford to just plant a tree because they're quite expensive. So if the government gave funds to people to be able to plant trees and all of these things that will help the environment, it would help the environment.
I can agree there is a limited amount of the consumer can be responsible for. Obviously, we have our own individual responsibilities, such as to recycle and not be wasteful and take more environmentally friendly ways of travelling. But a lot of these decisions on climate change are more out of our hands and in the hands of governments and corporations who have the main control over the direction of climate change. It's easy to feel like some of these individual measures are futile when the government is set to open up things like a new coal mine in Cumbria, for example, as this shows the government is willing to make a quick profit on the back of our futures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about sort of what we can and can't do, but I think one thing that we all agree on is that we can show our voice, if you will, in our society. And for example, the protests and environmental groups such as Greenpeace and
Extinction Rebellion. Speaking of Extinction Rebellion, we managed to catch up with our Bristol coordinator, Nigel Shipley, who told us a bit about what the organisation does.
I'm Nigel Shipley from Bristol, and I've been involved with XR for about 3.5 years or so, and gradually got sort of more and more involved. Last year, throughout all of 2022, I was the external coordinator, which meant I'm the person who links between Bristol and a group called The Hive in XR. The Hive is where representatives from all the regions and nations around the country come together to talk about what's going on, and I was the Bristol link. But
what personally attracted you to Extinction Rebellion? Why not other climate groups? And is there something more that could be offered by Extinction Rebellion?
What attracted me? Well, it's just the horrendous situation we're facing. And the thing that moves me the most is the thought of my grandchildren, little children aged 4 years old. They're going to see the other end of this century when the scientists are very clear we're going to be deep into a climate crisis, and it's going to cause terrible suffering, and they're going to experience that. Mm-hmm. I want to be sure that I've done everything I can to try to avert that.
Yeah.
So that's what sort of moved me to get involved. And also thinking about the terrible message which the scientists give us, I think one of the ways to deal with climate anxiety is to do something positive that you believe is going to make a significant difference. And I believe that XR is making a difference.
Sort of focusing more on Extinction Rebellion specifically, is there anything about Extinction Rebellion as a group, as opposed to, say, Greenpeace or other activism?
Well, the point about Extinction Rebellion is we get out and do stuff. Mm-hmm. you look at Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, the Green Party, there's an awful lot of hand-wringing. And if we could generate electricity from hand-wringing, then we would have the sustainable energy sorted. But that's what they're doing. They don't do anything. Yeah. We get out there and hit the streets.
Okay.
So, also, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, have been around for decades, and we've known about the climate crisis for 50 years or so, and nothing has happened until Extinction Rebellion came along and changed public opinion from thinking, eh, well, it's probably not really a problem, I don't really believe it, to now, the vast majority of people accept that climate change is real, it's serious, the politicians aren't doing enough. And it's because Extinction Rebellion has been banging the drum and ringing the alarm bell and saying, listen, 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 look, look, look. And so we have made a difference where those other organisations haven't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Harry, do you want to go on into the next question?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Would you elaborate on the demands of Extinction Rebellion, the sort of three demands, the acknowledgement, yeah. What do those values mean to you and to the group?
Well, the three demands, the first one is tell the truth. And, of course, tell the truth is absolutely vital because you can't deal with any issue unless you're facing up to it honestly. But the media, politicians, education, everybody is trying to avoid telling the truth. Climate change deniers are given space on newspapers, in the media, on social media. Politicians, you know, the net zero scrutiny group in the Tory party are trying to say, oh, we don't have to do anything about climate change. 2050 is a long way away. It's going to be too painful. Let's not do anything. There are so many people trying to divert attention away from doing anything about climate change, and they're copying the things which the tobacco industry did for 50 or 70 years to avoid facing up to the fact that smoking kills you. And it took all that time for us to get through to the truth. We haven't got time to avoid the truth with climate change. So tell the truth is the first demand, and it's something that we can keep hammering on whenever we hear a politician, a newspaper, some media outlet trying to avoid the truth, trying to divert us from taking any action. Second one, act now, is obviously we must act now. We have known about climate change for decades. We've taken nowhere near enough action. As a result, we're in deep, deep trouble right now. And the United Nations climate change scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tell us that there is no way that we can get out of this situation unless we act immediately. We have a very short window of opportunity to make drastic changes if we're going to avoid the tipping points from which we will not be able to return. And so it's absolutely urgent that we act now. And the third demand is around we need a new form of democracy. Democracy doesn't work. Our political system, whereby we elect politicians once every 5 years to represent us and to make changes to the laws to protect us from whatever, doesn't work because our politicians are, for one reason or another, unable to address climate change. It's too big a problem for them. It's too toxic a problem because the issues are so complicated. And it would cause so much disruption to actually address climate change that they just run away from it. So our political system isn't working, and Extinction Rebellion says we need a completely different overhaul of democracy, an upgrade to democracy in the form of citizens' assemblies.
And so the next question we want to ask is sort of around the kind of the media, what was seen most in the media about Extinction Rebellion, which is the kind of direct action that's used, which has seemed to be disruptive, so we just want to get your take on that. And can you sort of
when Extinction Rebellion was first formed, the founders, people like Gail Bradbrook, they looked at the situation in sort of 2016 and thought, we've known about climate change for decades and nothing has happened. The people like Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace and so on had been writing to MPs, writing petitions and had a little protest with a sign, peacefully walking down the street. Nobody took the blindest bit of notice of it. What are we going to do to make a difference? So they looked at climate, social change movements from the past that have made significant differences. People like Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the suffragettes, what did they do to bring about very significant change? Well, they went out there and caused trouble. They disrupted. They engaged in nonviolent direct action. So as a result, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the suffragettes were locked up in prison. The media hammered them, but they got their message across and they made a difference. And there's So the founders of Extinction Rebellion looked at what precisely did these successful social change movements do, and they came up with a list of things to do in order to be successful. The first one being, be nonviolent. If you're a violent organization, you're much less likely to be successful. Cause disruption, because that way you grab people's attention, you get the attention of the media, you get noticed. If you just do something quietly, nobody takes any notice. Show respect to people, show respect to the public, to politicians, to the police. Don't get aggressive towards them. Engage people's emotions. If you just tell people the facts, it doesn't make any difference. If I tell you that Standard Chartered is a financial organization which finances fossil fuel industry, you're beginning to go to sleep already. But if I tell you that Extinction Rebellion went to their headquarters and sprayed the front of the building with red liquid that looks like blood flowing down and shouted out, you have blood on your hands.
Yeah.
People inside realize, what you mean, when we pay for a new coal mine to be built, then we're guilty of causing climate change. And that's causing people to die. Oh, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So engage people's emotions is an important part of it. So the things which Extinction Rebellion does, which the newspapers might want to present as just a bunch of loony people doing crazy stuff, in fact, it's based on an evidence-based study of what works, what has worked in the past for the most successful social change movements. And so we're based on that evidence, we're doing what works. And it does work because we have moved public opinion and they now take much more notice of climate change.
As the government's put restrictions on the right to protest, how does crime sentencing in courts affect Extinction Rebellion and how will you adapt to this?
Well, the government's response to us highlighting climate change is to try to silence us. They tried to silence us by arresting us. So in 2017, there were 30,000 people from 2019, there were 30,000 people from Extinction Rebellion on the streets of London, and 3,000 people were arrested for that. And the courts just let them off because the police had no right. They hadn't committed any offence. So that didn't work. Now the government's trying to say that you're not even allowed to say in court, mention climate change in your defence. They've made the sentences very much more harsh. People are spending months in prison now as a result of actions. So the government is trying to silence any discussion about climate change, and that's their way of addressing a problem which is going to lead to utter disaster for all of us. So for Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, which of course is an offshoot of Extinction Rebellion, we will carry on. We will carry on. Now, you may have seen that in January, Extinction Rebellion made an announcement, we quit. And it grabbed a lot of attention. And what we said was, we will no longer disrupt the public. So we will not block roads. Extinction Rebellion will not block roads to disrupt the public. We will disrupt big business, governments, the media, organizations, but not the public. And we did that because we realized that we to make the next stage, achieve the next stage, we need to bring on board people from right across the spectrum of the population. And for many people, the idea of disrupting the public puts them off getting involved with Extinction Rebellion. So people tell us time and again, I like what you're doing. I like your aims. We support that entirely, but we don't like your tactics. So we're changing our tactics to make it easier for people to come on board. And that's why we're now recruiting people to come to the big one on the 21st of April in London. Have you estimate that by 2030, 700 million people in Africa will be displaced by climate change? Well, by displaced means they'll become refugees with nowhere to go. Yeah. And this is the world's top scientists telling us that. That's half the population of Africa. Already, vast number, hundreds of millions of people are on the edge of starvation because of long-term droughts.
Yeah.
This is what's happening now. Look in the shops today at the empty shelves where there aren't enough vegetables for sale.
Climate change is a pressing issue. This many of our listeners would agree with. But tackling climate change is going to have adverse economic effects. Hypothetically, if you had the opportunity to advise this government, how would you both deal with the issue of climate change and still protect certain aspects of the economy?
Well, if you think the economy is suffering as a result of addressing climate change, wait until the climate crisis hits. And if you haven't addressed it by then, the economy is going to be completely destroyed by climate change. We must do everything we can now to reduce the impact of climate change. We can't avoid catastrophe, but we can reduce the impact. And if you're concerned that it's costing a bit of money now, just you wait. Coming around the corner are monumental costs as a result of climate change. And we can reduce that disastrous impact on our economy by addressing the issues today.
Would you also say that climate change, contrast to sort of capitalism? Can you have climate change with capitalism? Is the pursuit of profit always going to be put forward against sort of like the needs of climate?
The system we live in at the moment, where we have a consumer society and politicians pushing for growth, coming crashing headlong into the climate crisis. So if you're continually gobbling up all the world's resources and at the same time destroying the environment, you're very quickly going to get to a situation where you don't have any resources, whether they're minerals to make goods or whether they're food to eat. It's just not going to be there. And so the idea of a capitalist society, which is based on continual perpetual growth, is going to hit the brick wall. It is already. We've had very little growth in recent years, but you can see things falling apart all around us every time you look at the news. And so it's not Extinction Rebellion that's going to bring down capitalism. Capitalism will bring itself down. And we need a completely different way of living.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and finally, we just want to sort of get your take on what you think the way forward for Extinction Rebellion is, just briefly.
For Extinction Rebellion, the way forward is to work together with many other environmental and social change groups. So I'm involved with building links with small and large environmental groups so that we all stand side by side, and Extinction Rebellion is not just on its own. So the big one in April will see not just Extinction Rebellion outside Parliament, but other large environmental groups and small groups and people from all over, bringing everybody right across the whole spectrum of the population, young and old, straight and gay, rich and poor, and people from across the spectrum, from a right-wing conservative to left-wing socialists, because everybody, the great majority of adults in this country, something like 85% of people, accept that climate change is real, the politicians aren't doing enough. They may have different perspectives, but people across the whole spectrum agree that we have a problem. What Extinction Rebellion needs to do now and is doing is bringing together people from right across the spectrum so that you have a weight of numbers which the politicians can't ignore.
Thank you very much.
Well. Yeah. Okay, cheers.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There has been a dawning sense of the climate crisis since the 1970s, with the first large-scale environmental movement being Earth Day, which called for the protection of all life, as well as the founding of one of the first environmental groups, Friends of the Earth. In 1979, the First World Climate Conference was held, paving the way for climate change to become a political issue, as well as in 1988, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed, allowing the first instance of global cooperation on climate change. Since this, there has been many initiatives to tackle climate change, such as the Copenhagen Accord in 2009, agreeing to keep global warming below 2 degrees. In more recent history was the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015, which stated that all countries needed to reduce their emissions by 50% by 2030 in order to limit global warming. Although the success of these programs has been limited, which has led to a growing number of climate pressure groups such as Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain, who feel like the UK is not taking climate change seriously enough and wants to push public opinion to take further action to ensure this and future governments take the threat of climate change seriously.
One thing that I found quite interesting about the interview was that Nigel mentioned that other climate groups such as Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth do a lot of hand-wringing, so I'm guessing he meant that he doesn't feel like they do a lot. But I would have to disagree, because I think Greenpeace has heavily aided in the mitigation of climate change around the world. So Greenpeace was founded in 1971, which compared to Extinction Rebellion's 2018 has been around for a lot longer than obviously Extinction Rebellion has. So Greenpeace works quite closely with governments all around the world to investigate and document the causes of environmental destruction. And in October of 2015, Shell, the oil and gas company, had announced that they were giving up their plans to drill for oil in the Arctic following the years of Greenpeace protests around the world. And Shell themselves even came forward to say that the protests had had a massive impact on the decision and ultimately their reputation. As well as this, 2 years of Greenpeace protests encouraged the UK's ban to use plastic microbeads in products such as shower gels and facial scrubs in 2018, which obviously opened the door for the start of preservation of ocean life. So, in my opinion, to say that they don't do much is a big reach. And perhaps the reason that Greenpeace aren't considered as effective in mitigating climate change is because their methods aren't as extreme or disruptive. But nonetheless, these climate groups have very successful methods of generating conversation and interest about climate change.
So I think you make some really good points, Ketsia, about Greenpeace and the successes that they've had. But I think Extinction Rebellion kind of look at it in a different way. And as they say on their website, they are an international movement that uses non-violent civil disobedience in an attempt to halt mass extinction and minimize the risk of social collapse, which I think you'll agree is definitely a much more extreme description than what Greenpeace might say. And so although Greenpeace have had some successes, Extinction Rebellion are looking at it in a very different way, and they're focusing more on or portraying more of a mass extinction and a risk of social collapse, which in their eyes needs a much more direct approach through direct action. So Nigel makes some really interesting points that XR was founded on the basis of this, and that it was founded on the basis of successful historical movements that have in large part been successful because they chose the route of direct action. For example, in 1928, women got the right to vote, and that was thanks to the protests and other direct action by the suffragettes, who were a controversial but effective group at the time. The other examples he gave of successful direct action was Martin Luther King and Gandhi, which are both now looked upon as some of the most famous historical figures, thanks to the vast social and political and cultural change that they brought about to the United States and India, respectively. And although it can be difficult to see the benefits of direct action whilst it's happening, and especially tough to work out whether or not a specific act of direct action has been successful in itself, I believe that in the future we'll look back on Extinction Rebellion as one of the great social change movements that prevented and or mitigated against the climate crisis.
Unfortunately, what makes Extinction Rebellion so noticeable has caused the organisation to be looked negatively on by some media outlets. Not just right-wing press, who have a particularly negative view of Extinction Rebellion, but most press have a far from fond view of it. This is due to Extinction Rebellion challenging institutions of power in this country. Chomsky's view is that the media is serving the institutions of capital. Perhaps this is true, which explains why the media have a negative view of Extinction Rebellion, as the cost of dealing with the climate change will limit the profits of many powerful corporations.
We hope you found some of what we've talked about interesting today.
If you've got any thoughts and opinions about what we've said, please tweet us at BRadio.
Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.